This is a Carlisle ValueCast, brought to you by the Carlisle Group. ValueCast brings you insights from our One Carlisle Network, providing analysis, data, and observations to help you navigate the global economy and top-of-mind issues in news. The Carlisle Group. Invest wisely. Create value.
Greetings and welcome to Carlisle ValueCast. I'm Chris Ullman, head of Carlisle's Global Communications. Today, we're joined by David Rubenstein, Carlisle's co-founder and co-CEO. Welcome, David.
My pleasure.
David, the Great Recession has ended, but its impact will be felt for years. Today, we're going to talk about the top 10 changes to the private equity industry following the Great Recession. First up is increased regulatory and public scrutiny.
Private equity sometimes is often thought by people to really mean private. Now, actually, private equity means the type of investments that people in this industry do. It doesn't necessarily mean that we're private or secretive, but there's no doubt that we can do a better job than the industry has done. And in Carlisle's case, we are very, very transparent, and many other firms of our size are increasingly being very transparent about who their investors are, the kind of ways they operate, how they manage companies, and I think that's a good thing. So public scrutiny has been greater than it was before, and I think that's something that is a plus for the public and a plus for firms like ours. Following the Great Recession, the government in the United States and the governments in other countries looked at private equity and other types of financial industry management, and they did toughen up regulations and toughen up oversight. For many smaller firms, that is a difficult burden. For a firm of the size of ours, we can handle those regulatory oversight. There's no doubt that there is much more stringent look at private equity than there was before. In Europe, there is such stringent overlook at private equity and regulatory oversight that it is a real burden for many firms operating in Europe, particularly the smaller firms that are not based in Europe. So while we're equipped to deal with some of these things, I think some of the smaller firms are now not really equipped and able and have the resources to do some of the things that they really would like to be able to do.
Number two, the emergence of the individual investor.
Historically, private equity got most of its money from large public pension funds or other institutions that were considered to be institutional investors. In recent years, we've begun to see that the individual investor has saying, I would like to get some of the high returns that these institutional investors are getting. And they're saying that particularly because many of them who have bank deposits are realizing that they're getting very, very little returns, if any returns, on those bank deposits. So increasingly, large institutions are rounding up in what we call feeder funds, these individual investors. They can come into our funds with a lower minimum, effectively, because they're being rounded up in a much larger partnership pool by a larger organization like Credit Suisse or Morgan Stanley or Goldman Sachs. And so we are now getting much more individual investors through these vehicles than we ever had before.
Number three, sovereign wealth funds and high net worth individuals have taken over as the fastest growing investor segments.
Public pension funds were historically 35% or so of the investor base for large private equity firms like ours. However, in recent years, that percentage has gone down a bit as sovereign wealth funds from all over the world and high net worth individuals are now coming in increasingly into private equity. So we're seeing the influx of money from both of these organizations, sovereign wealth funds and high net worth individuals coming through feeder funds. And it's been very good for the private equity industry. I know that private equity firms are very much valuing the relationships they have with these type of organizations, sovereign wealth funds and high net worth individuals. And I suspect their percentage increase in private equity will continue over the next couple of years.
Number four, capital coming in from new geographies.
Historically, private equity got most of its money from the United States. Then later in the 1980s and 90s, Europe began to invest in private equity. And probably in the latter part of the last century, you saw some money coming in from Asia. But now you're seeing enormous amounts coming in from all the emerging markets, Latin America, the Middle East, Southeast Asia, India, so forth. And I think that reflects the fact that these parts of the world now have much more money than they did relative to 5 or 10 or 15 or 20 years ago. And so increasingly, we think that is going to be one of the biggest changes you're going to continue to see in private equity. More and more money coming from outside the United States and particularly from the emerging markets.
Number five, how fundraising dynamics have changed.
Fundraising has always been relatively difficult for private equity because you have to take a long time to raise the money. If you're doing an IPO, you can get that done in a month or so. If you're doing a bank offering for debt, you can do that in a month or so. Private equity funds typically take a year or more to raise. Now the average is taking about 17 months to raise. Many years ago, it took about just 9 months to raise. The reason it's taking so long now is that investors are just more cautious than they were before. They're demanding better terms and negotiations take longer, and there's much more competition. So fundraising dynamics have changed in the sense that it's now harder, longer, and in many ways more frustrating for people trying to raise money. On the other hand, because people are making 10-year commitments, it is understandable that people are very cautious before they make these commitments.
Number six, institutional investors are looking for more than just alpha, and they're also interested in a greater variety of products and strategies.
Traditionally, we often said to our investors, we have a good rate of return and we think we can do that again, and that's what they really focused on. But now what investors want is information beyond good returns. They want to know what we think about geopolitical developments. They want to know what we think about asset allocation formulas. They want to know what we think about what's going on in the industry. And so they're really asking for more information than they did before. And they're also quite interested in how we value the companies that they have invested in. So we do spend much more time, and the industry is spending much more time, giving information to investors than just giving them good returns.
Number seven. Traditional private equity firms are becoming alternative asset managers.
There are several thousand private equity firms around the world. There are probably just seven that are global alternative asset managers. And I say that global, I mean they have operations all over the world, and they're probably managing $75 billion or more. And so I think you're seeing an increasing percentage of investors saying, I want to be with somebody that can invest around the world, that's very stable, going to be around for a long time, and can do many different things for me, not just the same thing that one fund could do. And so I think that trend is likely to continue.
Number eight. Fee pressure is real, but is more focused on management fees than carry.
Traditionally, private equity professionals were compensated by getting a management fee, which largely covered their cost, and 20% of the profits or carried interest. There has been some pressure on the management fee, but not all that much. There has been some pressure on so-called transaction fees and deal fees, and they have largely gone away, though not completely so. But there's been relatively little pressure on the carry, the 20%. It's generally viewed that 20% incentive compensation is a very fair way to compensate private equity managers.
Number nine, the institutionalization of the industry.
Historically, private equity firms were more or less mom-and-pop organizations. When KKR did the famous RJR deal in 1989, they were a firm of probably less than 10 investment professionals. Today, you're seeing a number of firms becoming institutionalized in the sense that they have large infrastructures, they operate all over the world, and they're not as dependent on one or two very good investors. They're really organizations that can survive their founders, and people don't worry about one or two people in an organization perhaps not staying there. So you really have the institutionalization of the industry in a way you didn't see 10, 20, or 30 years ago.
And finally, number 10, increasing focus on operational improvement versus financial engineering.
In the early days of private equity, financial engineering probably played a larger part in private equity firms getting the high rates of return they did than today. In the early days, very little equity was put in, and complicated financial structures were used to enhance the returns. Today, it's recognized that good returns really have to come from better operational management of the company that has been purchased. And so the private equity firms have added enormous numbers of people with experience in operating companies. They are helping to either run these companies, serving on the board, or serving as advisors of the companies. And therefore, operational improvement is really what is driving the high rates of return that private equity firms are able to get today, not financial engineering.
David, thanks for joining us on Carlyle ValueCast.
My pleasure to be here.
Thank you for joining us. For more information, go to our website at carlyle.com. This has been a Carlyle ValueCast podcast.